Before we start on the message itself, this is a night where spreading out might be useful. You notice that you have a paper-clipped set of notes as well as a stapled set of notes. I would recommend that you put the paper-clipped notes like this in front of you. One of the pages in the upper right says that it's the one that's the upper one. And then you have one that says put this sheet on the lower left, another one put this sheet in the lower middle, and the other one says put this sheet in the lower right. So you have one sheet that starts with Adam and Eve up at the top, that goes at the top. And then you have one that has Shem, put that the lower left, and then in the center, the one that is Ham, and then Japheth on the right. Some of you have noticed that we're going to be covering 32 chapters. Chapters 4 through 35. If it were 4 through 34, it'd be 31 chapters, but it's 32 chapters. And like Ricardo said, we'll be here for a marathon. Please open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And I'm going to tell you a funny story based on a verse here. Probably most of us are familiar with Latter-day Saints and how they have a huge genealogical library in Salt Lake City. And so anyone who's doing serious genealogical research ends up making contact eventually with the Latter-day Saints in order to get some of their data that they have in all of their files in order to make it so that it's easier to track down your long-lost ancestors who have, in most cases, gone from life to death. And there are all sorts of dusty records that have been converted into microfilm there in Salt Lake City in this huge vault that's underneath this mountain, and it's supposed to be safe from nuclear attack, and they've got, you know, all their genealogical records. Do you know why they got interested in genealogy? 1 Corinthians 15, verse 29. One verse started it all. Otherwise, what will they do? What will they do who are baptized for the dead if the dead do not rise at all? Why then are they baptized for the dead? And you might wonder, well, how did this get this whole genealogical project going? Well, for years and years and years, Latter-day Saints would talk about their great hero, George Washington. And they were always talking about him. Then someone said, but you know, there's a problem. George Washington wasn't a Mormon. And so they started digging around and they found this verse and they said, will someone please volunteer to be baptized in George Washington's place that he has a second chance? And then what they decided to do was to try to find the name of every single person that ever lived on planet Earth so that someone could be baptized for that person to give that person a second chance. Now, that's not what this passage means at all. I can't tell you what it means. But I'll give you two possibilities. Someone compiled a list of 256 views on 1 Corinthians 15, 29. There probably are more. But let's make note of the sentence structure. What do you notice about 15, 29? You have two sentences, and what kind of punctuation do both of them end in? Question mark. So what you would have to say is, Paul asked a question. Do you see where he gave an answer? No. Imagine, they've got all of these vaults containing all of these genealogical records because they have taken an interpretation of two questions. Not two statements, two questions. And so, in boiling down the possibilities for interpretation of this verse, I'm going to ask a very serious question. Does Paul tell you whether he practiced baptism for the dead? No, he doesn't. So there are two possibilities that have to be taken into account when one tries to interpret these verses. The first one would be, what might Paul mean if he didn't practice baptism for the dead? What would he be doing in this verse? And then the other possibility is, what would Paul be saying in this verse if he did practice it? So, let's assume for the moment that he didn't practice it. What he's saying is, there are some people out there that baptize for the dead. Doesn't that sound like they believe in the resurrection? So if Paul doesn't accept the idea of baptism for the dead, he would be saying, you Corinthians respect someone else who baptizes for the dead. That tells you that those people that you respect believe in baptism for the dead, doesn't it? So Paul would be using that to help them re-examine their position. Okay, that's one possibility. I quite frankly think that Paul believed in baptism for the dead. And I had some startled looks as I said that. What kind of dead people? Spiritually dead. When you have a baptism service, don't we invite unbelievers there? What are we telling them when we have a baptismal service? This person was identified with Jesus, and Jesus identified with him in his death, and he was raised again to life, and baptism is a picture of death to life, and Jesus gives everlasting life to those who believe in him. But what is the status of someone who has never believed in Jesus Christ? They're dead. There was a professor of seminary at a seminary, and one time he was asked to do a funeral service. And so the family was riding in the hearse as they were going out to the cemetery, and so there wasn't any room for the official, professor who was going to be doing the ceremony. So he rode in the front seat with the hearse driver out to the cemetery. And the hearse driver asked him, it's always bothered me. There's this verse in the Bible that says, let the dead bury their own dead. What does that verse mean? And what this professor said, well, that's a perfectly good question to ask. You see, out in the back of the car, there's a dead person, right? And have you ever believed in Jesus Christ? The man said, no. He said, well, you're a dead person because you don't have everlasting life, and you're going out there to bury a dead person who's died physically. When we have a baptismal service, it's for the benefit of the dead, isn't it? It's for the benefit of spiritually dead people to present to them the picture of believe in Jesus Christ in order to receive everlasting life. So, you know what? I don't know what the verse means. I don't know if Paul endorses baptism for the dead or if he wasn't meaning to. There are at least 256 interpretations of the verse. We're not going to get into it tonight. But let's go to Genesis. And you might be thinking, wow, this is pretty ambitious. We're going to be covering lots and lots and lots and lots of verses. Well, yes and no. What we need to do is quickly review the book of Genesis. Genesis, and what chapters? 1 and 2. So 1 and 2 is creation. And then, what happened after creation? Fall. Okay, and that was in Genesis 8, or where was that? 3. Okay, and then after that, what happened next? Cain murdered Abel. And then after that, what happened? 5 and 10 genealogies. Wow. 2 chapters devoted entirely to genealogies. Let's take a look. Take a look at Genesis chapter 4, verse 16. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city, and he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. To Enoch was born... Hey, it looks like we've got a genealogy at the end of chapter 4, doesn't it? And it goes all the way through chapter 5. And then when we skip over to chapter 10, lo and behold, genealogy continues. We've got a genealogy there that runs through chapter 10. And then we get into chapter 11, and lo and behold, look at Genesis chapter 11, starting with verse 10. And we've got a genealogy running all the way through chapter 11. I'm not going to preach on each and every individual genealogy as we get to them. We're going to have a sermon on the genealogies. Okay, so we're just going to put together the genealogies, and you might be saying, uh-oh, this is tune-out time, genealogies, boring. So-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so-and-so. And you say, yeah, you know, when I started reading that chapter right before I went to bed, I didn't get very many verses, and I was sound asleep. Well, I don't like boring sermons, do you? So I don't think we're going to have a boring sermon now. Okay, so we have Genesis chapters 1 and 2, creation chapter 3, we have the fall, then chapter 4, we have Cain murdered Abel, then we have chapters 5 and 10, genealogies, chapter 6 through 8 is the flood, and then chapter 9, rainbow, chapter 10, genealogy, chapter 11, Tower of Babel, and then we get into Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. That's the whole book of Genesis. Wow. Let's look a little more closely at a flow of the chapters that we've... Let's see. Before we get there. We have to review something that we raised right at the beginning of this series. In the middle of your notes on page 1, when was Genesis written? 1446 B.C. Who was it that wrote it? Well, that was Moses. And to whom did he write? He wrote to the Israelites. And we had said that he had preached the basic contents of the book of Genesis prior to the point that he wrote the book. But he wrote it in 1440, or soon after 1446. 1446 is the year of the Exodus. That's when the Red Sea parted. Very soon after, he's written this book. And you remember what the big thing that God said? God said, I want you to tell Pharaoh, and I want you to tell Israel something. What did God want Moses to tell them? Yahweh, Jehovah, I am, sent me. And remember how it went time and time and time again? It's like, he told Israel. Then he told the sons of Israel. And you know, he kept repeating it time and time and time and time again that Yahweh, Jehovah, sent me. And what was being communicated by that was that God is a faithful God. Yahweh or Jehovah is the name of God as he enters into covenant with people. God was saying through Moses, I will be just as faithful to you as I was to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, if that's the message of that Moses was needing to communicate, he needed to make sure that they understood how faithful God was to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and the promises that he had made to them. Okay, so it is written to the Israelites, and their circumstances at the time, they were slaves in the land of Egypt, but when Moses was telling them about this, but then soon after, they were wandering in the wilderness, and they ran into a little problem. Let's look at Exodus chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. Here they are out in the wilderness. Now, you might say, you know, that's a lot of pages between Genesis and Numbers chapter 20. But even though it's a lot of pages, it's not very much time. You know why? You have the end of the book of Genesis, and then what happens right after that? Israel is in slavery. Moses is born, and God raises Moses up as a deliverer. And so then through all of the 10 plagues, God caused Pharaoh to let Israel go. And they were out in the wilderness. They weren't out there all that long. They were out there, well, it seemed to them a real long time. It was only approximately 40 years, 38 years. And interestingly, despite all the number of pages that we have, when we're here in Numbers chapter 20, we're still in that 40-year period of time. In fact, we're fairly early in that 40-year period of time. This isn't very long after 1446. Well, now, here we are in Numbers chapter 20, starting with verse 1. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first of the month, and the people stayed at Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. Okay, we've got a big problem that's happened here. But now there's going to be another problem that's going to develop. Still at Kadesh. Drop down to verse 14. Now Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel. Huh. Doesn't that seem like a strange statement? How was it that Moses knew that he was supposed to treat the king of Edom as brother? Your brother Israel has a little problem here. The genealogies are going to tell us the answer. Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians afflicted us and our fathers. When we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent the angel and brought us up out of Egypt. And now here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. Please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through the fields or vineyards, nor will we drink water from the wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we have passed through your territory. But Edom didn't treat them like a brother. Edom didn't let them go. Let's turn to Numbers chapter 21. After they've dealt there with the problem there, they have another area that they're needing to go through. And this is in the area of Moab. But we have an interesting situation here. Let's start with Numbers 21:21. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites. Now, this is not in the land that would normally be considered Amorite territory, but this is in the land of Moab, saying, let me pass through your land. We will not turn aside into the fields or vineyards. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? They're saying, we just need to get through. We're not wanting to be at war with you. Just let us go through. But verse 23, Sihon would not let Israel pass through his territory. Drop down to verse 26. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land from his hand as far as the Arnon. Okay. So what's the situation is they are going through an area that's the land of Moab, but it's being ruled right now by the Amorites. Moses has to know whether to fight with a group of people or whether to have peace with them. And the genealogies are what gives the answer. You know, you often hear people say, oh, the Old Testament is war, 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 war. And the idea is to annihilate them until there's no one left. But look at how Moses treated these countries. The genealogies give the answer. So I think it's kind of important for us to have an idea of what the genealogies are doing. Most people don't know what the genealogies are there for. And if you're reading something and you don't know what you're supposed to get out of it, it's kind of hard to get into it, isn't it? And that's a big problem that's happened, is that generally there hasn't been good instruction on why are the genealogies there. Let's turn to page 2 of the notes. In order to set up for the genealogies, what we need to do is do a little closer review of what we've seen thus far in Genesis. We know that in Genesis chapter 1 up through 2:4, we have the restoration of the universe that happened in 6 days, and God took a rest because he was really, really tired after working so hard. No. He rested because he was done. But on day 1, God is dealing with light. And on day 4, he dealt with light. Day 2, he dealt with the firmament in between the cloudy waters above and the liquid waters below. And what did he do on day 5? He filled the firmament with birds, and he filled the sea with sea creatures. Day 3, he made dry land appear, and he made plants appear. Day 6, he filled the land with land animals, with people. Now we saw that the clue to all of this is in Genesis 1:2. The earth is formless and void. God needed to make the earth ready for habitation, and that he did in forming it. Days 1-3, light, separation of waters above and waters below by having sky in between, and day 3, causing dry land to rise up out of the water. Then he proceeded to fill. The earth was filled with light, greater amount of light during the day and a lesser amount of light by the moon and the stars to create days, months, seasons, and years. He made it so that the earth could have an order to it that would allow people to live on it. Then on day 5, God filled the air and the sea with animals. And on day 6, he filled the land with animals and with people. But was there a population explosion? Not yet. But God said it was formless and void, and he needed to fill it. But what he did was he made it so that the sea creatures, the birds, the land animals, and the people were able to be fruitful and multiply. That was the way that the filling would be accomplished. God put in place that which would, within creation, so that creation could accomplish what God had set before it. We saw that Genesis chapter 2, verses 4 and following, does a recap of the sixth day. the first three verses look at God resting because he had completed creation. But then verses 4 through the end of chapter 2 are a focus on the sixth day, and it goes into more detail, showing how he had prepared the garden and the steps that he took to show the man that indeed it was not good for him to be alone, because if he were alone, the earth would never be filled with people, would it? And so then, God has created this perfect universe, and he has put in the garden everything that the people needed. There was a tree of life that unfortunately they never seemed to get around to. Have no idea what it was that made it so they didn't get around to it, but they certainly did find, with the help of a friendly little tourist guide, they found their way to that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, of the blessing of God and the cursing of God. And in the very day that they ate of it, dying, they died. Even though everything has looked very bleak at this point, God has put everything into creation to make it so that even though man turned his back on God's offer of life and instead chose death, God made the promise of the seed of woman. And in the course of time, Jesus Christ came to planet Earth so that he could fulfill the promise that God had made of life instead of death to those who believed his promise. So we have cursing turned into blessing by God. But then in chapter 4, all of a sudden there's Cain and Abel, and it doesn't take long, and Cain decides, well, you know, my brother is showing me up, so I've got to do him in. And it's bye-bye, brother. And we saw that God was not satisfied with Cain and with his offering, but he was willing to give him a second chance. He said, sin is crouching at the door, but you can overcome it. He said, try this again. Cain didn't do so. Sin instead overcame him. We saw that that's pointing to Cain being a believer, because would God be telling an unbeliever, do some works and I'll be happy with you? No. God was speaking to a believer, but a believer who became overpowered by sin. Well, then, all of a sudden we get into these genealogies, and the big question with the genealogies becomes, what is Moses spending all this space, all this time, talking about genealogies? And we start out first in chapter 4, verse 16, with the genealogy of Cain. Take a look at your handout that I've told you how it should be arranged. You have a top sheet, and that's the one that starts out with Adam. Then you have three lower sheets. The lower left sheet is the one that starts with Shem. Then you have Ham in the middle, and Japheth on the right-hand side. Now, we already saw in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have acquired a man, the Lord. She thought seed of woman was being fulfilled. Not so, but it does tell us about the content of faith that she believed. But then in verse 2, then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Then we drop down to right near the end of Genesis chapter 4, verse 25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. So as you look at the top sheet of the genealogy, you'll notice we have Adam and Eve, and then in 4:1 we have Cain, 4:2 it should have been for Abel, and then 5:3, among other passages, mentions the birth of Seth. Now, Abel's line does not continue, because Abel was killed before he had any children. But we have Cain's line and Seth's line. Now, guess which line the seed of woman comes through? Seth's line. So you'll notice those people who are in the messianic lineage are in bold. So all the bold entries are for the messianic line. Those that are not bold are not. Now you might notice that there are some entries where there's an underlined italic entry. That's for the women. And the men are in non-italicized, non-underlined text. I'll tell you why I ended up choosing to do it that way. Look down on the left-hand side of that top sheet, and you see a person by the name of Ada. And you'll notice that Lamech had two wives, Ada and Zillah. So I didn't maintain the consistent man on the left, woman on the right. I found it easier to put Lamech in the middle. So that's the reason that I'm using italic and underlining to indicate women, and the men are non-italic, non-underlined. What Moses tells us here in Genesis chapter 4 is about the lineage of Cain. Now, that lineage didn't really go on for a real long time, because in the course of time, there was a flood. The only lineage that made it through the flood, how many people were on the ark? 8. And they were Noah and his 3 sons. So what we have with the... when the flood happened, the only lineage that remained on planet Earth, counting lineages through the father's line, which is the way that the Bible does, Seth's line is the only line that remained on planet Earth. But Moses wants to let us know something about the line of Cain. And so he gives it to us. So we start at verse 16 of chapter 4. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, which on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city. Now, when he builds a city, that's kind of telling us there are a few people around, aren't there? Kind of hard to build a city if you don't have any people. And when you think about it, look at what Cain was worried about just a few verses earlier. Verse 14 of chapter 4. We'll start with 13. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and I shall be hidden from your face, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth." That's kind of hard to be a farmer, isn't it? And that was what his trade was. He's saying, oops, I'm going to have to find a new line of work. But then there's an even bigger problem. And it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. He say, well, wait a moment. All Moses has told us about is Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. Abel's dead. I don't know that Cain's going to be very worried about Adam or Eve killing him. Kind of sounds like there are a lot of people here, right? Well, what the Bible doesn't do is it doesn't mention a lot of the other kids that were born. These are the children that were the ones mentioned in the text because the narrative needs to make mention of them. But there were a lot of other children born. I can't imagine how many kids Eve must have had. I mean, you know, Adam lived for over 900 years. And biology seemed to be a little different then, because I don't think that Eve stopped giving birth to kids just because she's 110 or 120. I mean, you know, she's just a spring chick, so she just kept having kids. And Cain is very nervous because population's growing pretty fast, and he's saying, somebody's going to be out there to get me. He's able to found a city, and we just don't have all of these numbers of people mentioned. We're going to have a few places where there will be hints of them being around. Okay, well then, he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. So now verse 18. To Enoch was born, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. So if you look on your top sheet, I have that basic genealogy recorded here. A couple of details we might want to look at. We notice that Lamech took two wives. He decided, let's make the population explosion go even faster. Let's try to catch up here. And so have people dwelling in tents with livestock, so it sounds like they're nomadic. And saying, you know, he seems to be the first guy that got that type of an idea. Verse 21, he has a brother who is interested in music and made some instruments and so forth. So you have a lot of creativity here that seems to be going on among these. And then Lamech says, boy, I'm going to make a name for myself. I'm really going to take vengeance anytime anyone does anything to me. So, in summary of this, I've skipped something here. Actually, we're on the top of page 3. I'm sorry. So we have Adam's descendants through Cain was given through that section. And then the end of this Toledot, verses 25 and 26, will give the descendants through Seth. Now, I managed to distract myself, so I didn't give you what is on page 2 of Kinds of Genealogies. So let's go back there. Sorry for going out of sequence. There are different types of genealogies. Some trace pedigree, and they narrow to a single descendant in each generation. And so I have a sign indicating they narrow. They start out broader, and then they narrow down. The pedigree of the Messiah, how many people in each generation would be counted as seed? We saw in our study in Galatians, it's one per generation. You can't have for example, with Abraham, the messianic line being both through Isaac and through Ishmael. It has to narrow down to one. So you can have a lot of children, but it narrows down to one. So Abraham, two sons, but it narrows down to Isaac. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. But the line through whom the Messiah would come narrows down to one, Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, but it narrowed down to the lineage through Judah. So some genealogies, you see them eliminating a lot of the people, a lot of the descendants, and focusing on one lineage. You think about in England, Prince Charles and Diana. Well, you know, the big question arises. Well, after Queen Elizabeth dies, someone needs to take the throne. How many kings are they going to have? They'll have one at a time. it looks as though the lineage is going to bypass Charles because of all of his problems, but it goes down through one, because you need to have one monarch at a time. You can't have a number of them. When you have genealogies that are looking at a narrow lineage as to who will be the inheritor, who will be the Messiah, who will be the king, it will narrow down. The pedigree of inheritance of land within the tribes of Israel. As you look at that, there will be aspects of it which will narrow down. Then if you go to group relationships that mention lots of descendants, they're looking at a different standpoint. To see, especially in chapter 10, are going to open up for national groups and to show who can Israel enter into an alliance with, and who are they supposed to say, no, we can't enter into an alliance with you. And that basically came down to those that ended up sitting on the land of Israel as squatters. Those that ended up in the land that needed to be evicted, they could not enter into covenant relations with. And Moses, as he is recording this, as he's recording these, is being very careful to point out with whom they could and with whom they could not enter into alliances. Okay, now we can turn back to page 3. Notice in Genesis 5:1, this is the book of the genealogy of Adam. More literally, these are the generations of Adam. That's one of those Toledot statements. This is a new outline section in the book of Genesis. So, notice how we had verses 25 and 26 of chapter 4, the end of the preceding Toledot, and who did it focus on? Seth. And what happens in chapter 5? Chapter 5 is going to expand on that. Notice this is one of those, meanwhile, back at the ranch. Remember how Genesis chapter 1 talked about days 1 through 6? Of creation. And what happened in chapter 2? It focused on day 6. Remember how early in the day God said, not good that man should be alone. What day did he say that? Day 6. Because was man there before day 6? Was man around on day 1? Day 2? 3? 4? 5? So what day during creation would God say, not good for man to be alone? Day 6. Okay, you look at 6 days in chapter 1, and then all of a sudden, ooh, let's take a close microscopic look at day 6, and that's what chapter 2 did. That's what he does here. We're looking at the descendants of Adam. 3 of their kids were named. You had Cain, you had Abel. Abel's dead. And then you have Seth. So the last 2 verses of chapter 4 talk about Seth's line, right? And then all of a sudden, we have a flashback, and chapter 5 is going to look at Seth's lineage. So, what that means is, right now, starting in chapter 5, we're here, and we're going to go down to here, and we're going to end up with the 3 sons of Noah. So we had a brief capsule. The last 2 verses of chapter 4 said, I want to talk about Seth. And then chapter 5 devotes itself to talking about Seth and his kids. So, the lineage is pretty straightforward. Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, and he's not in Australia, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Notice that all of these, except when you hit Noah, Noah is the last one here that's the that's exclusively messianic line, because then it's only one of his children that's messianic line, that is Shem. So as we look through chapter 5 rather briefly, we have in verse 3, Adam lived 130 years. By the way, they didn't have all the environmental things that we have now. They didn't have the sun blaring down, but it was filtered through clouds. Their climate was different. The level of canopy, everything is a lot different. With that rich oxygen, that's going to affect people's length of life. After you hit the flood, the climate starts changing. Everything starts changing. And so, you know, people kind of look back here and they say, wow, how could those people live that long? Well, if the earth was a lot different, it's going to affect the length of time that people would live. There are a number of other things that would be there as well. One of the big things that we don't often think about is there isn't a lot of time for genetic problems to have developed as it has during the number of generations that have come down to the modern era. Some of the difficulties that we face now are a lot different than what they were facing. The Bible doesn't go into a lot of detail here, but we do see Adam living 130 years before he begat Seth. And Seth lived a long time, and he had sons and daughters. Notice how only one of the sons is named, because Moses is focusing on that part that's immediately focused within his argument. We have a number of generations that are recorded here through chapter 5. For giving an overview, I'm not going to go into details. Let's now turn over to chapter 10. Do you know why I can skip all these chapters and go from chapter 5 to chapter 10? What happened in chapters 6 through 8? Flood. How many people were involved? 8 survivors. Okay, so we haven't moved very far afterwards. And then what happened in Genesis chapter 9? Rainbow. And so Noah is still alive. Noah is on planet Earth. So Genesis chapter 5 is summarizing who's gotten on planet Earth up until Noah and his sons. And then we start at Genesis chapter 10 with Noah's sons having kids after the flood. So we can skip those chapters because this just goes right together, because the genealogies just continue right on through. So now we'll start at Genesis chapter 10. Now, with Genesis chapter 10, we have one genealogy devoted to each of the three sons. And that's the reason you have three lower pages. But as we look at these genealogies, you can see how much width gets used, because an individual son could have a whole bunch of children himself. So notice we start in Genesis 10:1. Now these are the generations of the son of Noah. Guess what? This is the start of a new Toledot. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And By the way, this isn't the order of their birth. At a later point, we'll mention some details on that, not this message. Sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Mesech, and Tirith. And yeah, you look through here, and some of these people, they have a lot of sons named, right? How many daughters get named on these pages? None. So guess what? Moses is being selective. He's not mentioning everybody, is he? The way that Moses selected these people that got mentioned was, if Israel is kind of the centerpiece, which it would be from a biblical standpoint, because that's where God's going to be directing the nation to go. You look at Abraham. He started out quite a way east, and God directs him to get him over to Israel, to go west. And all these nations are surrounding Israel from various distances. But these nations are the ones with whom the Israelites would be having to decide, can we enter into a treaty with these people, or should we go to war with them? What about these people? What about these people over here? This section is designed to make it so that they have a basis for deciding with whom they can have alliances. Because what God does, and it comes clear later in later books of Moses, that the Canaanites were under a curse. And God would not allow Israel to enter into covenant with them, but they needed to annihilate them. They needed to take over the land. But there were other times that there would be other peoples with whom they would be dealing with that could be very close by, and they weren't supposed to go and annihilate them. They had to know who was under the curse and who wasn't. Who should they enter into an alliance with, and who should they always be planning to go to war with? It's kind of like, know your enemy. And that's what's going on here. He doesn't mention all the children, all the grandchildren, all the great-grandchildren, all the countries, but he's mentioning the ones that are in proximity to Israel, and that's why this is as selective as it is. You know, I had a friend in high school. He was Japanese. He was my debate partner. And he told me one day, I don't believe the Bible. And I asked him, well, why not? He said, well, when I look at Genesis chapter 10, back in that time it was politically all right to say Orientals, but any East Asians? So he said, I think the Bible's wrong because it's trying to say here are all the countries of the whole world, and it didn't even know about the East Asians. But let me ask you a question. Did Moses have to worry about entering into a treaty with Japan? No. The nations that are included are the ones that are close enough to Israel that they had to be able to know, was it all right to enter into a treaty or not to enter into a treaty? And so, as you look at Genesis chapter 10, it doesn't spend a lot of time talking about the Gentiles, does it? Under Japheth. Most of the Europeans would be understood as coming out of that lineage. We get to verse 6, and all of a sudden we're on Ham. But notice one of the sons of Ham was Canaan. And as we drop down there on Canaan, you drop down to verse 15. Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn. That's up in Lebanon. and Heth, the Jebusite. Do you remember where the Jebusites were? They possessed the land around Jerusalem. The Amorite and the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite and the Sinite, the Arvadite. And then notice it says afterward the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. Oh. Hey, look up a little bit earlier here. Look at verse 5. From these coastlands, peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands according to his language, according to their families, and into their nations. Hey, wait a moment. Tower of Babel is mentioned in chapter 11. Wasn't there only one language? And it says in verse 18, afterwards the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. When does Genesis 11 happen? Ah, glad you asked. Please look at Genesis 11:1. Now, we ran into one of those big nows. This is a meanwhile back at the ranch. What we have is a genealogical list, and we know that the Tower of Babel incident didn't happen during Noah's lifetime. It wasn't with Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But what happened is somewhere between the start of these genealogies up here, and as we get down into all these different peoples all over the place, people start being dispersed, speaking different languages because of the Tower of Babel. So in other words, remember I keep saying, don't think, oh, Genesis 10 happened before chapter 11. Because part of Genesis 10 happened before, but within the midst of these genealogies, at some point, Tower of Babel happens. But Moses tells us that by that now. It looks a lot different in Hebrew. It doesn't look like a now. It looks like a vav, disjunctive with a perfect instead of a vav conjunctive on a preterite. And instead of having the subject as the second word of the clause, it's the first word of the clause. So it looks a lot different. It's like the difference between looking at a Ferrari and an Edsel. I mean, they're much, much different. And we just get a little now that makes it just barely visible. But it's really visible as you're looking at the Hebrew text. And what Moses is saying in chapter 11 is, I'm not trying to tell you exactly where this fit, but I wanted to talk about the genealogies there, and I want to talk about this here rather than saying, okay, we'll take the genealogies up to this point, and here's where the Tower of Babel happened, and then I'll start the genealogies again. He said, I want to talk about genealogies, and then I'll talk about this. So, what we have is a history, an overview of what became of these various people, and actually they were propelled at a certain point by the Tower of Babel to start splitting up from each other and start spreading out and going different places. But lo and behold, into the land of Israel went a whole bunch of people that God said they were under a curse and they needed to be displaced out of the land. Now, I dare say, I think this is a little different view of genealogies than the kind that we normally have when we start reading and have one yawn, read another sentence, yawn again. We don't even get to the third sentence and we're sawing logs. What we have is the Bible is unfolding for us the picture of life and death. You know, that's inherent in a genealogy, isn't it? When you look at the obituary column, so-and-so was born at this point, here were their kids, here's their spouse, and then they died. And when we look at it from that standpoint, human life is extremely transitory, and what we see in a genealogy is the provision of physical life and the inevitability of death. But God's solution that he is portraying in the book of Genesis is one of everlasting life, which he promised back in the garden, that he told how he was going to accomplish it through the promise of the seed of woman. And all the way through, Genesis is causing us to look ahead, to look down the road, to look to the time when the Messiah comes, and to look at that lineage that's going to allow that Messiah, the son of the seed of woman, to be born. And Israel has to look. God has promised them a land, and Moses has told them about it. But as they know that, they have to know which countries they can enter into an alliance with and which ones they always have to be at war with. And Genesis is taking them from where they are as recently freed slaves, being out in the wilderness, and God's telling them, look ahead. Look ahead at my provision of life, and look ahead at my promise of the land to you. And these genealogies play an important role in helping Israel to see ahead. Not just to look at their daily life, but to look at what God is doing, because God has a long-range plan and he's aiming them at it. And the genealogies are part of that picture.